But yeah, we're in Mark 15, looking at Jesus getting mocked just before the crucifixion. Mark 15, 16 and 20. And as you guys may have known, if you've heard me preach at any point, you probably know that I'm a little bit into history, maybe a lot. And one of my favorite points of history are revolutions. I really love the English Revolution. I love the French Revolution. I'm actually writing a big paper on it at the moment for my uni. But the Russian Revolution particularly catches my fancy. It was fascinating that while Stalin was in rule, he had this thing called the Mongolian peasant. And he would send millions of people to the gulags. Many people would die. It was a very oppressive regime. And the way that he would justify sending these people to the gulags is because they would admit to crimes. And he could get them to admit to any crime he wanted them to admit to, or at least Stalin's psychologist. And the way that he did it was he told this analogy of the Mongolian peasant. He said that he would bring a poor man in, and the man would come in, and he'd see that the walls were made out of mahogany wood, and there were all these portraits and busts and bookshelves with really intellectual books on them. And this guy's a poor dude, so he comes in and he already gets this sense of authority, this sense of something way bigger than him. And as he comes in, he opens a drawer and he says, "There's a million rubles in here, and the million rubles are yours. You just have to push this red button. And if you push it, a Mongolian peasant will die. You will never know him, you'll never see him, but once you push it, he will die." And the man's like, "Why does this guy have to die?" He's like, "Well, don't worry about that. You push the button, you get the money. You don't, just walk out." And he says that the man will go forth and he'll push the button. And he'll take the million rubles and he'll go out and he'll be so full of shame that he won't spend any of it, and then he's going to die and the state's going to take the money back. This is the illustration that Stalin's psychologist used. And he said that shame is a powerful emotion. He could get anyone to admit to anything as long as he framed it as paying penance, as making up for the thing that they did. And so he would interrogate them until he found something shameful they did in their past. And when then he'd press on it and he'd say, "You'd be forgiven for that. The state will forgive you for that, but you have to admit to this." And apparently, it worked most of the time, and that's how Stalin got away with sending so many people to the gulags. Shame was so powerful that he could get people to admit to things they'd never done. And it is a powerful emotion, shame. Very powerful emotion. It's actually going to be the central theme of the last section of Mark. The last thing leading up to Jesus' crucifixion is not what we normally think, the pain and the suffering of Christ, it's the shame. It's mocking, it's the guilt, it's the scorn that was heaped on Jesus. One Old Testament scholar wrote this. He said that shame is a sense of our needs with ourselves at the heart of our being. Deep down, we know we have many flaws. There are things wrong with us, things we're ashamed of. In our culture, they try to deal with shame in so many fascinating ways. But it's such a force. It regulates our behavior, it regulates our emotion. If you want someone to stop doing something, shame. Quickly, they will stop doing it. Teachers use this all the time in the classroom. If a student's misbehaving, shame the student, and they will come and obey you eventually because they don't want to be shamed in front of everyone else. It's such an effective form of controlling people's behavior, controlling people's emotions, and they're going to try and heap the heaviest amount of shame on Jesus they can. They're going to try to break Jesus with the most tried and true method that works on every single human being, shame. And if you think that you're impervious to shame, you haven't really encountered someone pressing you hard on something that you do feel deeply, deeply ashamed about. So some people, they deal with shame different ways. You know, they think they're a strong, independent person. They don't care about their shame. But don't you dare talk about it because you're going to make them angry. Sometimes people just pretend it doesn't happen. They want to make sure everyone likes us. They hide away their shameful things. They bury it. They make sure people can't see it. And others, they just show it proudly. This is what I got going on. And the reason they have to show it proudly and make you agree with them is because they feel shame in their heart. That is why they behave like that. And psychologists will try to, that pull apart your childhood and be like, "Oh, you weren't loved here, or your parents did this to you here, and that's why you behave like this," and try to rid you of all shame. There was a prison psychologist who said that psychology enables delinquent behavior. And the reason he said that was because you would always explain away their actions with their childhood. He would say, "This happened, and this happened, and this happened, this is why you did this, this is why you murdered, this is why you raped, this is why you killed." And he said that he had a burglar once, and the burglar said, "Oh, Doc, I suppose that I burgle and steal things because of something that happened in my childhood. What do you think it is?" And he's like, "No, I think you burgle and steal things because you're lazy. You don't want to work for anything." And apparently the guy laughed at that. He's like, "Oh, that's true. I'm surprised that you guys would actually just tell me the truth like that." And he actually enjoyed it. He respected that. And so today, in the final hours of Jesus' life, literally the final few hours of Jesus' life, we're going to see shame heaped on him. We're going to see even try to break him. But Jesus will not be broken. So Mark 15, 16, and 20, if you've got your Bibles open for you. The soldiers led him away inside the palace. That is the governor's headquarters. And they called together the whole battalion. And they clothed him in a purple cloak, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on. And they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they were striking his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his own clothes on him. And they led him out to crucify him. As I said before, when we come to this, you watch the Passion of Christ, you watch a lot of that stuff, all of it, the focus of it is on the pain and suffering that Jesus went through, isn't it? It's all, they show you in gore and graphic detail everything that Jesus went through. But Mark makes very passing comments about the things that Jesus went through and instead focuses on the shame. I mean, as inhumane as the execution method was, as inhumane as Jesus' treatment was, Mark simply just brushes over them and moves towards the shame. In Hebrews 12:2, it says this, "For the joy set before Jesus, he endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God." Jesus despised the shame. He endured the cross, despised the shame, for the joy set before him. For what he saw, the goal that he had in mind, and he went through that ordeal knowing that he was going to purchase a people, that he was going to bring glory to the Father. And in this tale, we've got the soldiers. They've got Jesus now. And to them, he's a joke. Jesus is a joke. He's some Jew that they picked up. Crazy man who thinks he's some kind of king who would oppose Caesar. That's at least what they think. When they see Jesus, they see this pathetic man that everyone's abandoned. Where is his followers? Nowhere. What do his own people think about him? Well, they want to kill him. So the soldiers, they're stoked. They get to treat Jesus with all sorts of cruel forms of punishment. And these guys are skilled in punishing. These guys are skilled in meting out the worst kind of pain they can do without killing him. And so they see Jesus, they drag him away. And last passage, we see that he was scourged. Scourged. Have you ever heard that word before? Scourged. Now, there was an old Roman method of whipping. Very brutal method of whipping. It was done for the most heinous of crimes. It was the Jews, the law says you're only allowed to give 40 lashes, which means that the Jews not wanting to go over 40 because then they'd break the commandment of God, they would give 39 lashes. Just in case one slipped in somewhere, they would have that one lash of wriggle room. So Jesus underwent a scourging. Now, a scourging was a whip, a Roman whip, and it had three leather tongs on it, and they would embed all along it bits of metal, shards of metal, bits of glass, bits of bone. And the purpose of it was to rip the skin off your back. It was literally to rip all the skin off your back. And when you would finish it, your skin would hang in chunks off your back. It was brutal, like cruel form of punishment, as I said. And most people would die from it. Bones would show. Sometimes they would like just get really gross. And it's like sometimes intestines would come out. It was brutal. And so Jesus has gone through this. And yet Mark says one thing about it. He just says he was scourged. Move on. He could have dwelt on the pain. He could have dwelt on everything that Jesus went through there. But instead, he moves straight to the mocking of Jesus. And he spends time there. Now, if you're a Roman, you hate the Jews. Like, the animosity between these two groups was legendary. Murder was common. Roman soldiers would kill Jews. Jews would kill Roman soldiers. There was bad blood between them. They would raise young Jewish boys with the purpose of killing Roman soldiers, especially the Zealots, who were a group of Jews. And so the Romans, they get to take their hatred out on Jesus. And here is a king. Here is a king of the Jews, a representation of the Jews. All their hatred, all their malice, they can pour out on Jesus. All the hatred they have for the Jews, they can pour on him. And they thought it was a joke. They twist together a crown of thorns. Now, the Roman emperor, he'd wear a crown of leaves, like a wreath, like an olive branch sort of thing that you rub together, you wound together. And so instead they wound together a crown of thorns and they shove it down on his head. Well, it would not have been a fun experience. All the thorns would have gone into his head. Blood would have been running down. Blood's already running down his back. He's losing a lot of blood and probably could have died from those very injuries. And they chuck on him a robe. They pretend he's a king. They bow down to him and they give him a savage beating. A savage beating. They use sticks. John's account tells us they use their fists and they beat him to a pulp. All the while saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." Because you used to say back in those times, "Hail Caesar." That was what you would say to Caesar. Well, here's a king. Why don't we mock him? So they give him this savage beating. Have you ever seen anyone? I've seen one person after a savage beating, their face like purple and bruised, their eyes shut and closed. And it's brutal. And to think what Jesus would have looked like at this point, he would have been unrecognizable. In fact, Isaiah talks about that, how unrecognizable he was going through that suffering. And it's all hilarious stuff for the Roman soldiers. There's a hilarious act of utter contempt and hatred for this king. And in verse 20, Mark tells us that they lead Jesus out to crucify him. Now, in between this and that event, actually a whole bunch of things happen. In between them beating Jesus savagely, in between them dressing him up and chucking a crown of thorns, a whole series of events happen that John records for us in John 19, 1 to 16. And if you want to turn to there, we're going to spend the rest of our time in the sermon here, because for me, it is perhaps one of the most telling passages. It explains a lot of the crucifixion tale. It gives you a lot more information. So John 19, 1 to 16. All right. Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. And they came up to him saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and struck him with their hands. Pilate went out again and said to them, "See, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no guilt in him." So Jesus came out, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." When the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to the law, he ought to die because he has made himself the Son of God." When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. So Pilate said to him, "You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have the authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greatest sin." From then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at the place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha. And it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, "Behold your king." They cried out, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priest answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So they delivered him over to be crucified. Ooh, a lot packed into that, isn't it? It's a lot of that passage. So Jesus beaten to a pulp, his skin hanging off his back in shreds and chunks, is dragged in front of the Jews wearing this ridiculous king outfit. And it was a provocative move from Pilate. His purpose was to show him how absolutely ridiculous this whole situation was. Here's your king. It's supposed to be ridiculous. This is really the king, the guy who claims to be a king, the guy who claims to, challenge Caesar. This is the man. It's provocative. And all he achieved to do was make the Jews even more angry. They were astonished. They were disgusted. How dare he do that? How dare he dress Jesus up like that and pretend that he was their king? And so the Jews, just for the sake of knowing what's going on, the Jews had seven accusations. They brought seven accusations to Pilate for why Pilate should kill Jesus. These are the seven accusations. One, he threatened to destroy the temple. Two, he was an evildoer. Three, he was corrupting the nation. 4, he forbid taxes to be paid to Caesar. 5, he was stirring up the people. 6, he claimed to be king and was a threat to Caesar. And all of these accusations had been brought to Pilate, and all of them had no evidence, because none of them are true. None of them are true. All these accusations were lies. And so Pilate sees all this and he goes, this is ridiculous. This guy's done nothing wrong. You guys are only doing this out of envy. What does he mean? Well, Jesus is popular. He's got a lot of stuff going for him. You guys are just angry that he's taken away all your popularity. That's what Pilate thinks is going on. But in this passage, they bring accusation 7. It changes something, doesn't it? They say to Pilate, he made himself out to be the Son of God. And of all those accusations, this is the true one. And this one freaks Pilate out. Man is terrified. The Romans were pagans. They were very superstitious. Acts 14, Paul is going through a pagan town, him and his buddies, and everyone thinks they're gods because of all the miracles that they perform. And so it was fairly common back then for them to think that gods were walking among the people, especially gods that would perform miracles, do certain things like that. But there were this concept of demigods within pagan religions. And so Pilate's really scared because he thinks he could be sending to death one of the demigods. And that's not good. You only get on the God's bad side if you're a pagan governor. Who is this man? Because Jesus to Pilate is very odd. He's very strange. He doesn't act normally. He doesn't have normal human reactions. Pilate is a man who knows men. He is a man that knows what human beings are like. And here is Jesus, and he does not act like any man he's ever seen before. And he questions Jesus one last time, terrified this time. He says, where are you from? He's heard rumors of the Jewish rabbi going around Jerusalem healing people with sickness. He's heard probably rumors of Jesus out in the surrounding areas of Judea, this famous rabbi that's healing all these things and performing all these miracles, and he knows there's more to Jesus than meets the eye. To his frustration, Jesus doesn't say anything. He stands there and Pilate's stunned. He says again, you will not speak to me? He's stunned, he's shocked. He's like, don't you realize I have the authority to release you and the authority to crucify you? Now, Pilate sentenced many people to death during his time as a governor. In fact, he sentenced thousands of people to death. And this man has seen people on death row going to death. And when people are on death row going to death, they plead for their lives. They beg for their life, they make a defense, they try to counter the claims that are made against them. Some of them are all snotting and crying and wailing. Sometimes they pee themselves. It's true. These things would happen. Pilate's aware of this. But what is Jesus doing? He's calm. He's not answering. He's not defending himself. This is just shocking. It's mind-boggling. It's crazy. Why is Jesus like this to Pilate? So no matter what he throws at Jesus, no matter what pain, no matter how much physical pain he put Jesus through, Jesus never broke. No matter how much mocking the soldiers did to him, Jesus never broke. And now Jesus is going to break his silence. He says to Pilate, you would have no authority over me at all unless the peace had been given to you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greatest sin. And Jesus reminds Pilate one more time, you're not in control. You think you're in control of you? You're not in control. Jesus is in control. The Father is in control. The only authority that Pilate has was given to him by God. The only reason he is a Roman governor of Judea is because God willed for him to be the Roman governor of Judea. God allowed him to be there, and that is the only reason that he is there. Therefore, the greatest sin, Jesus says, is with the Jewish leaders who handed him over, who had rejected their own Messiah and were forcing the Roman governor to crucify their king. And so Jesus says, they're the ones with the greatest sin. They're the ones with the greatest sin. Now, God's still going to hold Pilate accountable. God still expects Pilate to hand out justice. God still expects Pilate to not be a coward. God still expects Pilate not to be an evildoer. And yet, Pilate is all those things. And so he will be judged. But he will not be judged. Well, he does not have the greatest sin in this. It's the leaders who are sentencing him to death. Romans 13:1 says this: let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And those that exist have been instituted by God. That's a fascinating verse right there. What Paul is saying in Romans is that no authority that has ever existed was not there because God did not allow them to be there. Because, what does it say? They've been instituted by God. Fascinating. Every political power that has ever existed is there because God allows it to be there. And after this, after Jesus says this, Pilate is terrified. Earlier in the Gospel of John, Pilate's wife has had a bad dream about Jesus and tries to tell Pilate to release him. That's all the right things for a pagan to be very, very superstitious. And yet, Pilate doesn't want to release him because he could cause a serious riot. His position will be in jeopardy. And so he comes out, but he wants to release Jesus. He doesn't want Jesus to die. He knows Jesus hasn't done anything. He knows there's more to Jesus than meets the eye. And yet he comes out about to release Jesus, and then the Jews say this to him. He says, if you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar. The Jews are kind of telling him that they're going to snitch on him if he lets him go. They're kind of like, is your allegiance with Caesar or is it with this guy over here? The Jews are saying this. They hate Caesar. They can't stand him. If they could, they would kill him. They're under an oppressive, tyrannical rule with the Romans, but they're willing to compromise on almost everything to get Jesus. All of their principles, all of their values, out the door. We want this guy crucified. We want him dead. Whatever lengths of hypocrisy, they're going to bring themselves to that. They'll complain to Caesar, this king is tolerating other kings and challenging his authority. Pilate, in history, by this point, is already out of favor with the Roman emperor. And he's hanging on a thread. One more thing that goes wrong with Pilate, he may end up being killed. He may end up being the one crucified. So he's not going to let everything go over this man that he barely knows. And so now the place of judgment, the stone pavement in Greek, Aramaic Gabbatha, meaning the stone courtyard. This is where the judgment's made. Is he going to kill him, or is he going to let him go? And John notes, he says, it was the day of the preparation of the Passover. As every lamb was being prepared for the Passover, as every lamb was about to be sacrificed at that great memorial when God, the angel of death, passed over the houses that had the blood of the lamb the door sides. That great day, when that happened, they're remembering that. All the lambs are getting sacrificed right now, and Jesus is being sentenced to death. Crazy. At that moment, on the Passover day, Jesus is going to be sacrificed, and his blood will be spilled, so that the angel of death may pass over those who believe in him. And he says to the Jews one last time, behold your king. There's many ways to read that. Is he provoking them? Is he trying to make them angry? Or is he trying to point out to them, hey, this guy can't be your king, look at him. This bloody pulp of a man who has currently zero followers, this guy is not your king. But instead they cry, away with him, crucify him. Pilate says, shall I crucify your king? And then get this last bit, they say, the chief priests answered this, we have no king but Caesar. We have no king but Caesar. Stunning that they would say that. That's like the last bit of shred of dignity, the last shred of integrity these guys had out the door. Pilate says, shall I crucify your king, your Messiah, the guy you've been waiting for a long time, the guy you think is going to overthrow us? And every shred of decency that they had left was now gone when they said we have no king but Caesar. Insane. These guys hate the Romans. Like, I can't overstate just how ridiculous this statement is right there. But they were full manipulating mode right there. They would say anything, they would do anything they needed to do to force Pilate to kill Jesus. They forced Pilate's hand. They made him kill Jesus. Psalm 118:22 says this: the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. The ultimate rejection. They rejected their one true king, the Caesar. The oppressive, tyrannical Roman emperor who had killed thousands of their own people, they were willing to ally themselves with Caesar and Jesus. Crazy, mind-blowing. And hatred does this to you. If you find hatred in the bottom of your heart, it makes you go insane. It makes people crazy when they hate people that much. It turns fine people with integrity into crazy people. And like, I don't like talking politics, but like, you only have to get on Twitter for a second. You only have to kind of delve into the news for a tiny little bit, and you see hatred everywhere. People spewing the most crazy stuff. People that see themselves as good people. Hatred does that. People having public meltdowns. You see these videos of people just losing their mind over Trump being president. I don't care what you stand on that guy, but when you have those kind of public meltdowns and your hatred is that intense, you just go crazy. This thing called Trump derangement syndrome, have you heard of that? People just going nuts over this. I don't care where you stand, that's not my point on that. People go crazy. And we come back to shame. Just like that psychologist could break anyone with shame, there was one man that could not be broken with shame, that was Jesus. Because Jesus was never broken, so can we who believe in Jesus also never be broken. Because he won that battle for us, we can win that battle. What do I mean? Well, the shame that you feel now, your present suffering, may feel like Uluru, may feel like Ezra, may feel like an enormous weight. It's this huge monumental thing. Man, that thing is weighty. It's the biggest rock, or at least above ground, the biggest rock. That thing is weighty, that thing is big. But compared to the eternal glory that we have with Jesus in heaven, it's like you put Ezra on one side, you put the planet of Jupiter on the other side of the scales. The glory and the that we will receive, the eternal glory that we have in Jesus, is so much better than the shame and the misery and the guilt we feel now. The Jewish leaders that fall into the trap of hatred, of anger, that heap shame upon Jesus and make sure he's killed. They will say whatever they have to say, they will manipulate Pilate however much they have to force Pilate to crucify Jesus. And these guys have won. Pilate gives in. He hands Jesus over to be crucified. Now Jesus is going to have to carry his own cross up to Calvary soon. He's going to have nails driven through his hands and through his feet. And even then, the Gospel of Mark just says that Jesus was crucified. And that's where it ends. Doesn't dwell on the nails being driven through his hands or his feet. What does Mark dwell on? He was mocked by the thieves that were beside him. He was mocked by people that walked past him. He was mocked by the soldiers. And he was mocked by the chief priests. All of the shame that they still tried to pile on Jesus, and he was never broken, even while he was dying. In a few short hours, the earth is going to quake, the sun will be darkened, the temple veil will be torn in two. The earthquake would be so intense that Romans would write about it, in their historians would write about it, feeling it all the way from Italy. The intensity of this moment when all of sin was poured out on Jesus, where he bore all our shame, all our guilt, and all we need to do is believe in him and trust in him and we will be saved. That work was done on our behalf. That is an amazing message. That is a message beyond all messages. That's a message that changed the world. The world would never be the same ever again. To this day, the gospel is going forward. To this day, the kingdom is growing. Right now. Where we are right now, people are being saved. And we can be a part of this, or we can be ashamed of the gospel. Romans 1:16, Paul said, I am not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God unto salvation. Why would he say he's not ashamed? I'm not going to be like, oh, I'm not ashamed of my mother. You mean like, dude, why would you say that? It would imply there was something to be ashamed about. And people tried to heap shame on the early Christians. Your message is ridiculous. A crucified king is ridiculous. People now heap shame on us, don't they? But we can be like Paul, we can say, we can be unashamed of the gospel. We can be unashamed of the gospel of Jesus for all that shame. This is true. It is the power of God to salvation. So Jesus went to the cross, said, guilty, shameful sinners like you and me could be saved. What a wonderful message. Let us never forget this. Next week we're going to get into the crucifixion. Oh, can't wait for it.